Welcome to History Extra on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. The first story is War Minus the Shooting. As the 2026 World Cup gets underway, Tony Shaw and Alan McDougall revisit 8 football matches played during the Cold War that turned the beautiful game into a battleground of ideology, identity, and state power. First, the fog of war at White Hart Lane. A chaotic 1945 friendly between Arsenal and Dynamo Moscow saw wartime alliance splintered by Cold War rivalry. It's not often that football friendlies spark conflict, especially between allies. The match between Arsenal and Dynamo Moscow, part of a tour of Britain by the Soviet Union's top team in November 1945, was intended to celebrate the Allies' recent victory over Nazism. But things went badly wrong on and off the pitch. Playing at Tottenham's Hotspur's White Hart Lane Stadium, Arsenal's ground at Highbury was unavailable. The British team bent the rules by fielding ringers such as England's Wizard of Dribble, Stanley Matthews. And the Soviet referee, perhaps with half a mind on the gulags, tested neutrality to the limits. Thick London fog, a real pea super, added confusion and controversy. Visibility was so limited that the players could barely distinguish teammates from opponents. Arsenal claimed that Dynamo cheated by sometimes fielding more than 11 men, slipping on substitutes unnoticed. Dynamo accused Arsenal of trying to maim its players. Soviet officials later alleged that Arsenal's capitalist manager, George Allison, had tried to get the game called off once his team had fallen behind because he'd gambled a fortune on a home victory. The match in the midst revealed a striking contrast in styles. Dynamo played a fast, fluid collective game built on discipline, short passing, and constant movement. Players interchanged positions, drifting across the pitch to create space. For British spectators accustomed to more direct football, the effect was startling. Perhaps it offered proof of the vitality of communism and a glimpse of the future of football. After Dynamo's thrilling 4-3 victory, both sides accused each other of bringing the game into disrepute. Writing the next month, George Orwell decried the orgies of hatred in such encounters, famously observing that international sport was war minus the shooting. The encounters suggested that ideological rivalry between East and West had reached the football pitch. 2. The miracle that remade a nation. With its shock 1954 World Cup win over Hungary, West Germany emerged from the shadow of Nazism. It's hard to believe now, but Germans were once football underdogs. On Sunday, July 4, 1954, in a rain-swept Wankdorf Stadium in Bern, Switzerland, the biggest match of the early Cold War saw the world's best team, the Golden Squad of Communist Hungary, pitted against capitalist West Germany in the World Cup final. The Magic Magyars, featuring the brilliant forward Ferenc Puskás, were hot favorites. The only question was how many goals would they put past the Germans. At first, the match went to script, and Hungary raced into a 2-0 lead. But West Germany had drawn level by the 18th minute, and it was still 2-2 in the 84th. Then Helmut Rahn rifled a shot. "Germany leads 3-2," exclaimed commenter Herbert Zimmermann. "Call me mad, call me crazy." Controversy erupted late on as linesman Mervyn Griffiths disallowed a Puskás equalizer for offside. Then the final whistle blew. West Germany were world champions for the first time. They call it the miracle of Bern. That was an exaggeration. West Germans had top players, a wily coach in Sepp Herberger, and screw-in studs on their Adidas boots, a huge advantage in muddy conditions. Miracle or not, Victory in 1954 helped Germany emerge from the shadow of Nazism. Budapest, though, rioted after their national team's loss. 2 years later, a popular uprising toppled communist rule. Puskás, like many of Hungary's golden generation, went west to continue a glittering career at Real Madrid. Hungary's brief time as a football superpower was over. Germany's was just beginning. 3. Church versus Communism. A bewitching Yugoslav team got the better of Ireland's footballers and incensed its religious authorities. "Football is like a religion to me," Pelé once confessed. "I worship the ball and treat it like a god." In October 1955, at the height of the Cold War, football and faith clashed head-on as the Catholic Republic of Ireland played against communist Yugoslavia in Dublin, and God lost. For much of the Cold War, Yugoslavia dominated Eastern European football. In the 1950s, it boasted one of the world's best goalkeepers, Vladimir Bera. When the team's visit to Dublin was announced in the summer of 1955, Irish sports fans licked their lips in the prospect of seeing the star in the flesh. Enter John Charles McQuaid, Catholic Archbishop of Dublin, and one of the most dominant figures in the history of the Irish Republic. He hated Yugoslavia's atheist dictator, Josip Broz Tito, who infamously imprisoned Catholic priests. McQuaid had successfully lobbied against a planned 1952 fixture between these teams, and now heaped immense pressure on Ireland's football authorities to cancel the 1955 game. The result was an almighty public row. Clergy accused football officials of betraying church and country by arranging the match. Officials argued that vetoing Tito's team would irreparably damage Irish football. The Yugoslavs cheekily responded by reminding Catholics of Pope Pius XII's view that politics should not interfere with sports. This time, McQuaid suffered a rare defeat, and the match went ahead in front of 22,000 spectators at Dalymount Park. The Yugoslavs demonstrated another communist team's technical brilliance. Their slick passing and inventive attacking play repeatedly exposing Irish defense. Tito's team ran out 4-1 winners. Irish newspapers exclaimed that the visitors' footballing science had bewitched and bewildered their opponents. Ireland lost on the pitch, but many later claimed that football dented the authority of the Catholic Church in 1955, so perhaps the country won something more important. Number 4. Franco, Khrushchev, and the Ultimate Grudge Match. Francoism and communism clashed on the pitch in the final of the 1964 European Nations Cup, a game that neither team dared lose. Madrid's stadium is always a cauldron. When Spain played the Soviet Union there in the final of the European Nations Cup, it was Francoism versus communism in the ultimate Cold War grudge match. Not just a battle, it was a war, recalled Barcelona's Jesús Pereda. Spanish dictator Francisco Franco was among the crowd on June 21, 1964. A Real Madrid fan, he liked football, but not as much as he hated communism. When Spain were drawn against the Soviet Union in the 1960 Euros, they forfeited the tie rather than send the team to Moscow. 4 years later, with Spain hosting the Euros, Franco's advisors ensured that the 1960 boycott wasn't repeated. The country was on the path to economic liberalism, and the Cold War tensions of the early 60s had receded. Semi-final wins for Spain and the Soviets set up the final both sides dreaded. Pre-match tensions were high. The president of the Spanish Football Federation even considered having the Soviet team poisoned. But all of this was forgotten when the game started. Pereda gave Spain an early lead, but the Soviets quickly equalized. Extra time looked inevitable until, with 6 minutes remaining, Marcelino powered a remarkable header past Soviet stopper Lev Lashin to give Spain a 2-1 victory. The Spanish press was a cock-a-hoop. Celebrations were widespread even in the outlawed Communist Party. But the feel-good factor didn't last. It would be 44 years before Spain won another international trophy. In Moscow, Nikita Khrushchev was furious, both with the result and with the image of a smiling Franco on TV sets across the Soviet Union. 2 days after the final, coach Beskov was sacked. Khrushchev soon followed. Leonid Brezhnev, a bigger football fan, replaced him as party leader in October 1964. 5. The Hermit Nation Steals British Hearts. North Korea players were the darlings of the 1966 World Cup finals, but they met their match in the men of an anti-communist dictatorship. The 1966 World Cup quarterfinal between North Korea and Portugal produced one of the most dramatic matches in football history, one shaped by the wider tensions of the Cold War. By that stage of the competition, the communist Asian team had already shocked Italy, but its performance at Goodison Park in Liverpool on July 23, 1966, was still more impressive. Fast, direct, and fearless. Within 25 minutes, North Korea led 3-0, exploiting defensive gaps with sharp passing and clinical finishing. The crowd watched in astonishment as a team from Kim Il-sung's Hermit Nation was overwhelming one of Europe's elite sides. The Koreans had become unlikely favorites with British fans, especially in Middlesbrough, where their earlier victory over Italy had forged a lasting connection still remembered today. New fans chanted the names of players from the East and waved improvised North Korea flags. Portugal, however, represented a different Cold War story. Under Antonio de Oliveira Salazar, the Iberian country was a staunchly anti-communistic dictatorship. Its team reflected imperial ambitions. Several key players were born in African colonies, embodying the regime's claim of a unified multiracial state. The quarterfinal match turned on endurance and quality. Portugal regrouped, slowing the tempo and asserting control. At the final whistle, they had won 5-3. The game was a classic of shifting momentum, early shock, mounting pressure, and eventual domination. Yet it also carried symbolic weight. North Korea's performance offered a rare, humanizing sight of a closed communist state, while Portugal's victory allowed Salazar's regime to celebrate both footballing excellence and imperial identity. 6. When regimes' dreams turn sour. When Zaire, now the Democratic Republic of the Congo, qualified for the 1974 World Cup finals in Germany, President Mobutu Sese Seko saw an opportunity to advertise his regime to the world. His nation had become the first from sub-Sahara Africa to reach the finals, and he intended to turn that success into a political triumph. Mobutu was a master of Cold War diplomacy. While he presented himself as a staunch anti-communist ally of the U.S., he cultivated relations with China and other socialist states, skillfully playing rival powers off against one another to secure aid and influence. Footballing success, he believed, would reinforce Zaire's image as a rising African power. Ironically, as it transpired, the team reflected Yugoslavia's growing influence across the developing world. Yugoslavia frequently sent sporting experts abroad as informal ambassadors in an attempt to strengthen diplomatic links through football. When Zaire faced Yugoslavia in their Group 2 clash, it proved an embarrassing mismatch. The communist teams experienced side-dominated, exploiting defensive errors and scoring repeatedly. The final score of 9-0 remains one of the heaviest defeats in World Cup history. The humiliation had frightening consequences. Before Zaire's next match against Brazil, rumors spread that the players that Mobutu had threatened punishments if they suffered another embarrassment. Several later said they even feared for their lives. That fear produced one of football's most famous moments. Before a Brazilian free kick, Ilunga burst from the defensive wall and blasted the ball upfield. To spectators, he seemed confused about the rule. In reality, it was a desperate attempt to disrupt play and avoid further shame. The episode revealed the darker side of Cold War sports, in which political pride could transform a football match into something far more dangerous. Number 7, the Derby of a Doomed Dictatorship. A bitter cup final contested by Bucharest neighbors exposed cracks that argued revolution. Did football ever help overthrow communism? Well, maybe. Take Romania under the tyrannical rule of Nicolae Ceausescu. For much of his dictatorship, Romanian football wasn't very good, but that changed in the 1980s. Leading the way were Romania's most powerful clubs. This was Army versus Secret Police, the team run by Ceausescu's son, against the team of the hated Securitate. There was no love lost in the eternal derby. Dynamo won 3 league titles between 1981 and 1984, taking 5 straight championships and sensationally the Eastern Bloc's first European Cup, an upset win over Barcelona in 1986. Tensions peaked in the 1988 Romanian Cup final in Bucharest. It was 1-1 in the 90th minute when sub Gabi Balint's winning goal was contentiously ruled offside. The furious team stormed off the pitch. Dynamo's bemused players eventually lifted the cup in front of their delirious fans. The bad blood continued. Dynamo's players turned their anger on the authorities in March 1989. Legend has it that defender Andon walked toward the VIP box, dropped his shorts, and flashed Valentin Ceausescu. Most likely, he raised his middle finger at the dictator's son, a defiant gesture that earned him 3 months banned from playing. Before 1989 ended, so did communism in Romania. Nicolae Ceausescu was executed on Christmas Day. His regime's downfall had more to do with political repression and economic misery than football, of course, but the combustible rivalry showed that the state wasn't always in control, or even on the same page. Football was a canary in the coal mine, signaling explosive change ahead. Number 8, a new world order. China's victory in the opening match of the 1991 Women's World Cup signaled the rise of a superpower. By late 1991, the Cold War was thawing and communism had collapsed in Eastern Europe. Francis Fukuyama had predicted the universal victory of liberal democracy, and it seemed that a new world was coming, shaped by American power. But there was room, too, for smaller players and a communist superpower. This was the backdrop of the 1991 Women's World Cup. Away from the Olympics, women's sport had been largely ignored during the Cold War, and women's football survived with little support from the game's powers. The winds of change, though, eventually blew into Zurich, where FIFA, hardly a feminist bastion, recognized the PR value of women's football, as did FIFA's biggest untapped market, the People's Republic of China. FIFA awarded it the first Women's World Cup to be held in November 1991. It was a controversial choice. In June 1989, Deng Xiaoping's government had crushed pro-democracy protests in Beijing's Tiananmen Square, killing hundreds or possibly thousands. Hosting a major sports event was part of China's international rehabilitation. Today, we'd call it sports washing. On November 16, 1991, at the stadium, China played Norway in the first Women's World Cup game. Some 65,000 spectators watched the hosts win 4-0. Though China went out in the quarterfinals, Norway reached the final, losing 2-1 to the USA. These three countries led the women's game in the 1990s, a crucial decade of growth. More than 90,000 people watched the U.S. beat China on penalties in the 1999 World Cup final in California. Bill Clinton received the winners at the White House, saying, "It's going to have a bigger impact than people ever realize." A quarter of a century later, football is no longer relegated to the margin of international sport. Nor is China, which has hosted 2 Olympics plus other Women's World Cup in 2007. The Cold War might be over, but sport remains a potent weapon in the tussles for soft power. Tony Shaw and Alan McDougall are the co-authors of Cold War Football, A History in 10 Matches. You're listening to History Extra on Sunsounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. In our next story, The Troubled Birth of England, The Collapse of Roman Rule in Britain, followed by the emergence of kingdoms established by Germanic tribes, marks one of the most turbulent periods in Britain's history. But what factors drove this dramatic transformation? Nick Higman chronicles the rise of the Anglo-Saxons. Throughout history, many Scots have harbored a lingering mistrust of the English. Plenty in Wales felt similarly. Edward I, the Hammer of the Scots, who also conquered swaths of land west of his kingdom, must take much of the blame. But the fundamental roots of these tensions stretch back to a time centuries before that bellicose English king, to the slow, messy, turbulent collapse of the Roman Britain and the arrival of the Anglo-Saxons. A whistle stop of the textbook history goes something like this. Iron Age Britain was inhabited by tribes of Celts. Then came the Romans, nearly 100 years after Julius Caesar's exploratory forays in 43 AD. The Emperor Claudius launched an invasion. Within half a century, the southernmost two-thirds of the island was conquered, creating the Roman province Britannia. As part of the Roman Empire, it was subject to externally appointed governors and protected by its army. But in the 5th century, the pivotal year often cited is 410, events in continental Europe drove the Roman authorities to abandon Britain. Within a few decades, Roman-style artifacts had been replaced in the archaeological record of eastern Britain by metalwork, pottery, burial styles, and buildings indicative of Anglo-Saxons, an umbrella name coined later to encompass Germanic tribes known as the Angles, Saxons, Jutes, and Frisians from northwest Europe. These settlers, or invaders, were those described by Bede in 7031 as English people. It's a neat story, and one with which many readers will be familiar. However, it's also a story that raises a number of questions. What drove the collapse of the Roman rule in Britain? How did Britain differ from its neighbors on the continent in this period? What attracted Anglo-Saxons to Britain from the 5th century? And how, by the beginning of the 7th century, were they well on their way to becoming the dominant force across much of the British Isles? To answer these questions, we must first examine the relationship between the people of Britain and the Roman administration through those centuries of imperial rule. The bonds that tie Britain to Rome, or more to the point, the lack of them, would have an enormous impact on what happened after that relationship began to fracture. Regional divide. During the Roman period, there were key differences between Britain's western uplands and its less hilly eastern areas. In the west, the dominant language remained Celtic, evolving into Welsh. Towns, villas, manufacturing facilities, extensive field systems, mosaics, and churches were lowland phenomena, leaving the westerly uplands as military spaces, particularly in the north, or areas given over to pastoralism. Yet a key point here is that even in lowland Britain, the Brittonic language survived. Britons were barely engaged in imperial frameworks. None was made emperor before 400, nor did any Briton enter the Roman Senate or attain high office. To Rome, Britain was always liminal, its inhabitants mere savage plowmen, as a Gallo-Roman poet put it. True, Britain's fertile lowlands contributed taxes in cash and in kind, and sufficient profit for landowners to commission sometimes lavish Roman-style villas. But in 353, these landowners' peace was shattered by the defeat of the usurper Western Roman Emperor at the hands of his eastern rival. His defeat was followed by savage reprisals in Britain, where he had enjoyed support. The contemporary soldier historian Marcellinus wrote that Constantinus' notoriously cruel representative, Paulus Catena, Paul the Chain, descended like a sudden torrent upon the persons and estates, whether guilty or not. This was a critical moment in the decline of Roman influence in Britain. Catena's violent intervention seemed to have triggered a transfer of confiscated property to overseas magnates, which may explain why so many villas became derelict. The resulting economic hemorrhaging from the province lowered demand and stifled manufacturing, importing, and service industries. Britain suffered economically and socially. The chaos didn't end there. Across the final quarter of the 4th century, Western Roman armies endured further defeats in civil wars, leaving them undermanned, ill-funded, and politically impotent. Britain's northern garrisons may have remained largely in post following this tumult, but crucially, Britain's lowlands to the east were undefended, opening the door to seaborne attacks. Britain was part of the Roman Empire for perhaps 14 to 18 generations. During that time, imperial protection had invariably been reimposed following crises. This time, though, was different. Honorius, emperor from 393 to 423, is recorded as responding to a plea for aid by advising British towns in 410 that they would need to defend themselves. This would have been understood by all sides to be an interim strategy pending the return of normal Roman governance to Britain. However, barbarian intruders in internal struggles on the continent continued to prevent the Roman recovery of Britain. Aggressive incomers. One Gaelic chronicler reported that circa 441, the British provinces were reduced to the rule of the Saxons. This seems simplistic and was written at a considerable distance, but it does suggest that incomers had by then seized regions, perhaps including Norfolk and the East Midlands. Gildas noted that Britons sought aid from the Western Roman general in defending themselves against Picts and Scots between 446 and 454, but no help arrived. Flavius's assassination in the latter year effectively ended any prospect of Rome's return to Britain. It was at this point in his narrative that Gildas began remarking on British kings, perhaps implying that some kind of government was emerging in a Britain independent of Rome. Act of folly. In Gildas's mind, the hiring of barbarians to defend the eastern coast, though common Roman practice, was an act of folly, leading to their rebellion and a great raid from sea to sea. While victories were won on both sides, the Saxons ultimately triumphed. An unnamed treaty to end the war, referred to by Gildas, seems to be recognized Saxon control of most of lowland Britain. Our knowledge of Anglo-Saxon population numbers, movements, and interactions in this period suffers from a paucity of relevant material evidence. But certainly in the more open, lower-lying regions of the south and east, a substantial labor force must have worked the land, implying that numerous Britons survived external takeover and remained in those areas, albeit not always toiling for their own benefit. Difficult relationship. The rift sealed the fate of the British and the dominance of the English in the lowlands south and east of the island, but the foundations of England and its cultural robustness have far deeper roots. The triumph of the Anglo-Saxons can ultimately be traced to Britain's problematic relationship with the Roman Empire. The Britons' retention of a Celtic language, their absence from imperial structure, the fact that much of their island's best agricultural lands were owned by magnates overseas, the fact that they identified primarily with Britain, all contributed to a peripheral status in the Roman world. So when the Saxon mercenaries they hired to help defend Britain against other barbarians rebelled, Britons were isolated and vulnerable, receiving no assistance from their former imperial rulers. Nick Higman is Emeritus Professor in Early Medieval Landscape History at the University of Manchester. His latest book is How England Began, From Roman Britain to the Anglo-Saxons. You've been listening to History Extra on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Music is Classical Royal British Music by D'Lo Sound. Remember, you can always catch a missed episode of Sun Sounds on our website. Please join us next time for an upcoming episode.